Application Academy is closing if you are applying to medical school in 2024 to start in 2025. We are closing in mid-April, April 12th or 13th, somewhere around there, somewhere in mid-April. We're closing our door. It's time for you to get in to Application Academy to get the support you need to put together your story so that you aren't one of those students that end up rejected because you didn't know how to tell your story. Come join us at applicationacademy.com. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. Use the promo code podcast for a little extra discount. I'll see you soon at applicationacademy.com. The pre-med path can be super confusing. If you'd love some help on your path or on your applications, use the promo code PMY for pre-med years, PMY, over at medicalschoolhq.net, and get some help from some of our experts, former directors of admissions, admissions officers, other experts. We have a small team ready to help you today. Again, that's promo code PMY to get a discount on our services at medicalschoolhq.net. If you're applying to medical school in 2022 to start medical school in 2023, join me Wednesday or Thursday, Wednesday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern, or Thursday at 11 a.m. Eastern at premedworkshop.com. Go register today. I'm going to show you how to tell your story in your application. Again, that's premedworkshop.com. If you are applying to medical school in 2022, be there or be square. If you're looking for more great content from the medical school headquarters, check out mededmedia.com. That's mededmedia.com. This is the pre-med year, session number 175. Hello and welcome to the pre-med years, where we believe that collaboration, not competition, is key to your success. I'm your host, Dr. Ryan Gray, and in this podcast, we share with you stories, encouragement, and information that you need to know to help guide you on your path to becoming a physician. Now, welcome back to the pre-med years. If this is not your first time with us, if this is your first time, thank you for taking the time to put me in your earbuds and stick me in your ears and listen to me for the next 30 minutes or so. But not just me. I have a special co-host with me today, somebody who hasn't been on for a long time. Welcome back, Dr. Allison Gray.
Thank you.
How are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm outstanding. It's been a long time.
It has.
Where have you been?
Upstairs. I've been here. I've been busy, and you've had lots of interesting guests on.
I think the listeners were starting to get worried that you just didn't care anymore.
Oh, that's shucks.
I get so many emails that say, we want to hear from Allison.
I think that that's false, but
I do.
Maybe you get one or two. No, but I'm flattered and it's good to be back.
Well, it's good to have you here. And we have an interesting topic today, an interesting discussion about things that we wished we would have learned in medical school. Things about being a physician, things about taking care of patients that at least our medical school didn't cover. And as we were doing some research, it looks like most medical schools don't cover. And I think you would agree with me that there's just so much to teach medical-wise that some of these that we're going to cover, just maybe just there's not enough time in the day and in 4 years to cover everything.
Yeah, and I think some of these are not taught because they can't be taught. They have to be learned through experience.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I'm excited to dig in. Why don't we start with the first one, which is one that I came up with and I think is very important and something you hear a lot of complaints about. And that's the lack of teaching about nutrition and informing physicians or future physicians at this point, how nutrition plays a role in health and in healthcare. And I think it's a huge travesty and a huge—I don't even know the right word. I think it's failure?
Just
a
missing?
Huge failure that we don't teach about nutrition in school. I mean, you talk about the number one killers these days. It's cardiovascular disease. It's heart disease, And most of that is tied to diet and obviously lifestyle, exercise, but diet's a huge part of that. And the fact that we're not learning that, we just learn the pharmacology behind it all and how to push pills at people instead of having those discussions. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree. And I think what happens on the other side of things is you are in the office and you have people coming in asking you about what is the role of diet in this disease or that disease, and what can I be doing with my diet to better my health? And you may have very little knowledge and really have to learn as you go. So that's unfortunate.
What if I play devil's advocate and say, well, they have nutritionists and dietitians and those types of people that are part of a healthcare team, and that's their job to know the diet part.
Well, I would disagree, because I think it is a team, but you have to at least have some knowledge. And if your knowledge is, well, go look at the food pyramid, then I think you're probably doing your patients a disservice. And I've had to do a lot of my own learning, and I think a lot of patients come to my office asking about, well, you know, what can I do for my brain health, and what kind of diet should I be on? And, you know, for example, like in epilepsy, there's a particular diet, the ketogenic diet, that can be helpful. But beyond that, I mean, there's really little in neurology about, in terms of training, about what diets are better for preventing Alzheimer's and what diets. And part of it too, is that we just don't know. So I think a lot of it also comes from just a lack of knowledge, about healthy eating. And the other thing too, Ryan, and we're going through this in our lives right now too, is we're experimenting with different ways of eating. We're trying the vegan thing now because we watched a documentary and learned about the dangers of animal protein. And I think that's just a reflection of the sort of the mass debate nowadays about what is the right way you should be eating. Should you be eating vegan? Should you be eating gluten-free? Should you be...
You know what I saw recently? Somebody, there's a blood type diet.
Oh yeah, I've heard about that. Yes. Yeah, I'm surprised you haven't heard about that till now. Yeah, I heard about that a few years back, and someone told me that they were eating the blood type B diet. And there was a celebrity, maybe it was Gwyneth Paltrow, or somebody
who was... Of course, it was a celebrity.
Well, it might have been. Who was...
The anti-vaxxers and the blood type diets, all the celebrities.
Well, anyhow, I think the anti-vaxxers is a much bigger problem than a blood type diet, but yeah. So there are all these diets out there, and some of them are crazy and terrible for you, and some of them are probably really good for you, but nobody really knows what you should be eating.
There's no double-blind placebo studies
out
there.
Correct. And just like a lot of things, yes, we don't have great data. And so I think that's where, you know, you take a mainstream Western medicine-based medical school and what should they be teaching? A lot of people even take issue with the food pyramid. And now I know it's not really a pyramid anymore. They changed it. Anyway, I think the punchline is there's a lot that we don't know, but if you decide to just be uninformed and not know anything and just say, oh, well, it's the nutritionist's job, then I think you're really doing yourself and your patients a disservice.
I agree. All right.
And the other big thing is you have to have B12. That's good for your brain. So
B12 is very important.
And your nerves.
And it comes from animal protein.
Yeah, but it also comes in bottles that say B12 on them.
Yeah, that's true.
Anyhow.
All right. So I think that's the first big thing that is missing from medical education. And I think it's a very well-known and very hotly debated subject that's missing.
Yes.
All right. Let's talk about the second one.
Well, I don't know what you changed the list on me. So what's number two? Ah, doctoring. Okay. So here's the thing. I when I was thinking about this topic, this is what came to my mind first. And I know we've talked about this before, maybe not on the podcast, but we've talked about this together, that medical school trains you in what you need to know to be a physician. But I don't think that medical school really trains you to be a doctor. I think that that is what your residency does.
Explain that a little bit more.
So if you go to a traditional medical school, the first 2 years you're in the classroom and you're learning everything you need to know about the body and about human disease and illness. And then in your second 2 years, your third and fourth years, you're on the wards and you're seeing patients. I think in at least my experience, I certainly on the wards, you learn how to take care of patients. You learn how to create an assessment and a plan, and how, you know, how are you going to diagnose whatever condition they're coming in with, and create a differential diagnosis, and how are you going to treat that patient, and how are you going to work on a team and see a bunch of patients during the day and try to coordinate their care. But I think that when you actually go in to the hospital on your first day as an intern, everything is just different. It's just different. And I don't think you can really articulate necessarily how, but it's just different. And maybe it's the responsibility that you have, because it's now, you're now a physician and you're now responsible for somebody and their life. But it's a very different experience than when you're on the wards as a medical student. And I think that med schools do the best that they can in preparing.
Med stool, huh?
Shush. We're all allowed to have a paraphasic error every now and then. See, now I completely lost my train of thought. What was I saying? Med schools. Yes. Med schools try to do as best a job they can at preparing you to walk in the, you know, and be a physician and do what you need to do to take care of patients in the hospital and in the clinic. But I don't think that, just from my own personal experience, and you can share yours, I don't feel that when I graduated med school, I was ready to be a doctor. And that's why we have residency. That's why we have internship and residency training. And that, I think, is where you really learn to really become a physician. And I think it was just interesting to me, because I remember so vividly how terrified I was right before a starting internship, and it was exactly for that reason. I didn't feel ready, and I don't think you can until you really start.
So here's my question. We're talking about stuff we wish we would have learned in medical school. So how does a medical school teach you that? Or you just said you really can't.
Well, yes and no. I think that a med school can do the best job that they can in that. I think I've seen, just, you know, when I was a resident and when I was a med student, when I was a resident, since I've been in attending, probably different schools have different ways of getting people ready. And people are therefore more or less ready to sort of do that. I think what I'm getting at, I guess, is that there are sub-internships or away electives, things that schools have set up so that you can try to get yourself as ready as possible for your internship. So, and different schools may have different requirements. In your fourth year of med school, there's a lot of, there's a lot of variability in what schools require. And I think, for example, a med school that required you to do an emergency medicine rotation, required you to do a radiology rotation, required you to do an ICU rotation.
Neurology.
Well, that's a given. And that's a third year rotation. So don't even get me started. But anyway.
Always required.
Well, it should be, but that's a different debate. And it shouldn't even be a debate, because that's just a clear fact that you need neurology. Anyway, you're getting me really riled up now. And I keep losing my train of thought. What I was going to say, yes, is that you need, in my opinion, my humble opinion, you need emergency medicine, you need ICU exposure, you need all of that required before you graduate med school. Because I think it will better prepare you for when you are an intern and you are in the ICU. And so for me, for example, in our medical school, we did not have a required ICU rotation. So my first experience being in an ICU every single day and working long hours was when I was an intern. And that's okay. And I figured it out. But I just think that the more exposure that you can give a medical student to critical care and acute care, especially when most medical students are going to be in an inpatient setting for their residency and working in acute care situations. So it's things like that, just to prepare someone as best they can. And it's very interesting. I mean, there's a huge variability in fourth year across the country with the different medical schools and what they require. And in my opinion, I think it should be more streamlined. It should really be more standardized. Yes, give people time to do electives. But it's just always been funny to me, because if you think about it, and this is, again, getting off on a tangent, but fourth year is the time when we have all this elective time, and that's when you already need to have decided where you're going and what you're doing. So if elective time is to really explore, then it's kind of in the wrong time, right? I mean, that really should be earlier, and there's no way to put it earlier, because you have to do all this required stuff, and then you need a time so you can apply to residency. So I get it, but anyway, I think that med students sort of have a lot of the same teaching and learning for the first 3 years. And then in fourth year, there's this sort of, it just completely depends. And maybe if people had more experience and more exposure to things, they would feel more prepared. I know I would have been, at least.
Yeah. All right.
So I don't know. I don't know what your experience is, Ryan, and maybe I'm just alone here, but
I think you nailed it all. I like it. All right. Let's talk about the third one here, and that's coding. How to properly code a visit and code procedures and code whatever you're coding. Because ultimately, that's how you as a physician get paid, is your coding. And for those that aren't that don't know about coding in ICD-9 and ICD-10, and that's fine. It's probably over your head maybe at this point. But knowing it now, and it's something that as you go through the process, you can start learning, because we're telling you it's important to know. And for me, this is another one where I'll lean on your expertise, Allison, because for me, being in the Air Force for 5 years, I didn't really have to know coding. I had to code, but it didn't really affect my paycheck because I was being paid by the Air Force and a salaried, basically, employee. But you, on the other hand, you needed to code, and that's how kind of you got paid, and it was tracked and everything. So from your experience, when you first left your residency training and you went into quote-unquote private practice, what was that transition like, learning how to code and making sure that you're getting every dollar out of the patient and out of the insurance company?
That's a terrible way to look at it.
But it's the game you play, right?
It's funny though, Ryan, because I don't look at it that way. Like when I was in my office last week, I wasn't looking, when I was typing in whatever I was typing in, Alzheimer's dementia, I wasn't typing it in as a code so that I could think about, well, how many dollars am I going to get for that? That never even enters my thought process. The reason that I need to code properly is because the patients, their problem list and their set of diagnoses need to be accurate. They need to, the tests that you order need to reflect the diagnoses that you're putting down. So, and then the patient will be billed. But it's funny because I don't think about coding every day when I code as, oh, okay, well, now I've put 5 codes in, so I'm going to get X dollars. It just doesn't work that way, at least in my mind.
Well, but that's because you're not the practice owner.
That is true. And so I'll tell you though, from my experience, when I left residency, so in my residency training in our clinics, and by the way, the only time you really get exposure to coding is not inpatient, it's outpatient. And for most residencies, it probably depends on the specialty, but for most residencies, you will have a certain amount of clinic time. And so you'll have something for most people called a continuity clinic, where you'll see patients throughout the year and you have clinic time, and then you might have your OR time or your inpatient time. And so in the clinic, you would be coding, but you would circle like a couple different things. So let's say you were seeing a patient and they were coming in with neuropathy. So you might circle your neuropathy code, and then you might circle B12 deficiency or something else. But then it was always this sort of like, I don't know, very superficial thing, because your attending would be there and they would sort of circle the right codes and look at what you did. But it was very, very superficial. And nobody was really showing you how to do it. They were just sort of saying, well, circle these things that you think are right. And there you go. And so when I went out into private practice, the person who hired me really showed me what I needed to do. And I remember him saying that you were, wanting to circle a certain number of codes, and because, to meet complexity. Thank you. Exactly. Of the visit, you need to meet a certain number of codes. And anyway, there is, as you say, there is a sort of game about coding, and it's kind of, nobody loves doing it because it's kind of a mess. But and ICD-10, by the way, created like 60,000 more codes.
65,000.
Yeah, than ICD-9 has. So there was the running joke when the new codes came out that people were putting all these signs on the wall, like, eaten by a killer whale. And that was literally, and that was a new diagnostic code. So the coding system.
Thanks, SeaWorld.
Yeah. Oh, geez. The coding system is a disaster. But it's doable. But it's just, I think from my experience, it was a little bit, I had my hand held a little bit when I went into practice, because I was working at a small practice. I had my mentor hire me. He showed me sort of what I needed to do in terms of coding. But I think you also learn a lot more. So interestingly, when I went to my next job, I actually had my first session with a coder and somebody who's actually trained in teaching physicians how to code properly. And I said to her, I said, why don't you guys go to medical schools and train people to do this? Because we, and residents, because we have no idea what we're doing when we come out. And she said that certain medical schools, like at UMass where I was working in my second job, they actually do spend some time with the residents in certain specialties going over how to code properly. And I learned so much in that session, and it just kind of blew my mind because she taught me things that I had not been doing for the past year and a half, and it was a little bit alarming. But the reality is that you need to be able to code properly for Medicare, for reimbursement, for all of these things. And you don't, if you go out there and you have no idea what you're doing, you're going to get yourself into trouble. So you definitely need to learn. It's an important thing.
Yeah, it's very, very important. And like I said, it's important. You just said for reimbursement purposes, yes, for tracking the patient and for databases for different diseases and things, it's very important. But at the end of the day, coding is very important for getting paid. And if it's not you that's getting paid, it's the hospital that's getting paid. And they're going to wonder where all the money's going to.
Right. So. And we didn't even talk about coding for procedures, which is a whole nother thing. So
yeah. Awesome. All right. The next one here is one that you brought up. I want to hear your thoughts on this one. Because I have a vivid memory of you, of I think one of your first times doing this.
Oh, geez. No, because, oh gosh. I know exactly what you're talking about, but anyway. So what we were thinking of talking about next is pronouncing a person. And what I mean by that is actually pronouncing someone dead. And there is something so unique about being a physician because being a physician is the only person who would do that. I mean, unless you're like in a zombie.
Depending on the state. Some states are different.
Is that true? Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. I was going to say, unless you're in like a zombie apocalypse and people are just dying. I will never, ever, as long as I live, I will never forget my first experience actually pronouncing a patient dead. It was during my internship. And it was a very, very, very sick woman. She'd been in the ICU and she was transferred to the floor and I was taking care of her. And I just remember being just, oh my goodness, just really overwhelmed. It was literally during my first week as an intern. And I remember her family and I remember it. And I remember other situations where I pronounced someone dead. Again, there's nothing that can sort of prepare you for that. So I don't think that, again, this topic about what do we think med school should sort of prepare us better for or teach. Nobody taught me in med school about this or what this was going to be like and what you're supposed to do. And you learn in your residency training, and a junior resident taught me what to do. But there's something, it's, you can't even articulate it really. There's something just so poignant about being the person to sort of send that person off. I'm sort of at a loss for words even to talk about it. But if you think about birth being, you know, when a baby comes into the world, I mean, it is just a monumental thing. And to be the person who basically states that this is the last moment of this person's life, and to be there often with their family at the bedside it's an overwhelming thing. And I think over the course of my residency, I had to do that quite a number of times. And it never becomes, and I don't think it ever should become, routine. You know, it's the last moment of another human being's life. So I guess I don't know that medical school should do anything differently. I mean, I don't know that it would even be appropriate to bring a medical student into the room with a family. I mean, unless they were taking care of the patient.
If they can simulate. You know,
well, true,
I guess. They didn't do that, at least at where we went to school.
They did not simulate it.
So what we learn is just what we see on TV. And I think that's what I was getting at earlier. I think you told me about a time where you pronounced somebody, and I think you were the only one in the room, and you verbalized like time of death, blah, blah, blah.
I did, because that's how I learned. And then I came home and told you about it, and you laughed at me, and I thought, why is that funny? And he said, because you don't have to do it like they do it on ER. Like, yeah. The TV show, Grey's Anatomy, I guess, for this next generation. Yes, but I don't know. But my devil's advocate to Ryan was that if you're in a room with a family, I mean, you sort of, how are they supposed to know? I mean, do you turn to them and say, well, they're dead? I mean, no, that's crude. And so I think there's actually something very, I mean, that's how the layperson sort of knows, like if they watch TV, you know, time of death. I mean, that's what they know and that's what they see. And I think that makes it easier for family.
You could say, I'm sorry.
You could say, I'm sorry, but they might think that I'm sorry about, you know, the person being near death or them being in this terrible situation. I don't know. What would you say, Ryan?
I'm sorry they're gone. I'm sorry they've passed. I'm sorry. I don't know. Time of death is just very formal and very, very Grey's Anatomy.
Well, anyhow, it's not where I learned it for all of you listening.
I think I've only pronounced one person dead.
Really?
Wow. And the hardest part for me was all of the paperwork that came afterwards.
Yes. And that's something so I saw that part of it actually during my medical student away elective. I was at Brigham doing my away elective, and I remember a patient dying, and the intern he was a junior resident who I was working with, he got all the paperwork and showed me what to do. So I had seen that before, but I think to actually be the person to pronounce someone, you're never going to be able to do that as a medical student anyway. It wouldn't be appropriate because, again, state law wouldn't allow that. From everything I know, at least, Ryan. But I think if, let's say maybe the medical student, you know, you're a med student and you've been taking care of a patient for a week and they're very ill, and let's say they pass away, maybe if it's okay with the family allowing, you know, the med student to go in the room with the intern or the resident or the attending when they're pronounced dead. I mean, it's maybe just something that's sort of good to see before you actually have to do it. I mean, you literally have to be taught what to do. Like, put the stethoscope on their chest, listen for a heartbeat, put the stethoscope at their neck, listen for a pulse, you know, feel for a pulse. And it's important stuff. I had a patient who we had thought died, and then all of a sudden he coughed, and you know, and all the family was completely startled because we thought that he had died. I'll never forget that one either.
He was just turning, like in Walking Dead.
Oh my gosh. Anyway, no, I think he was dying, but he had not quite died, and his family and we were all startled. I remember because I was listening to him at the time, and he coughed, and everybody in the room just jumped. But you really you have to learn how to do this. It's a big deal. It really, really is.
Yeah, it's one of those responsibilities. It's what's that quote, like, with great power comes great responsibility?
Absolutely.
Or something. It's a huge part of obviously at this point not the patient's life, but the family members that are involved.
Absolutely.
It's a huge part.
And I think for their life too. I don't often pronounce people anymore. It's just not part of my day-to-day life. I'm in clinic most of the time seeing patients, and if I'm in, you know, on call, we're consultants, so we're not the person, you know, taking care of the patient, you know, every single day, all day. We're there to step in if people need help from a neurologic perspective. So, but it's something I'll never, ever forget. I think, like you said, it's an incredible responsibility to send someone out of this world and to, you know, tell their family that they've died. And, I mean, you sign their death certificate. It's there are no words really, until you've experienced it.
Yeah. All right. So that was a big one, a profound one. This next one kind of goes back into similar area as coding and money, and that's value-based care and understanding that everything you do has a dollar amount plastered onto it. For heart disease or for high blood pressure, there's a million and one different medications, and they all cost something different. And typically what we know as physicians, it's what company has the biggest marketing budget that puts their name in front of our eyes the most? And that's what we know to prescribe. Or what company has the biggest marketing budget and has the most commercials that a patient comes and asks you because that's the commercial that they see more.
Yeah, but did you actually prescribe those medications first because of that?
You know the ones that you know because those are the names that you know.
Yeah, but I don't think, I mean, I'll just argue here that I think there's been a huge push to have residents really protected from pharmaceutical companies. And so many of you who've shadowed, you may have gone into offices and you've seen big signs that say no pharmaceutical reps. And in my residency training, wow, I mean, they were not allowed anywhere near us. And so I think I probably saw more commercials than anything else about some of the drugs. But it was interesting because in private practice, we, before the Sunshine Act, which changed a lot of things, we did have people come into the office to talk about different drugs during our lunch. And the Sunshine Act made it so that Medicare really tracks very, very, very closely exactly how many dollars a physician is taking from a pharmaceutical company. So for example, if you have a lunch and you have food for three physicians, each physician has to sign their name and they write down exactly how many dollars were spent on them for that lunch. So that changed everything, and we didn't have reps come in to the office after that. And where I am now, I don't really see any. But it's an interesting thing because I guess when you say that, when I think about like for a neuropathy patient, if I'm going to prescribe medication, what I start with is not Lyrica, which is the most expensive and the biggest, you know, I mean, you see it all over the, you know, on commercials. Lyrica is the number one drug for
That's not just for fibromyalgia.
No, use it for diabetic neuropathy and other things too. But the point is that I don't start there because it's extremely expensive and there are other therapies that are proven to be maybe just as good or better and they cost a lot less. They've been around a lot longer. So I think, to be honest, Ryan, where you learn how to prescribe drugs is really where you're trained in the school of thought. And you know, so my mentors in my neurology residency, they trained me in, okay, well, this is the medication that, you know, that we start with for this. And so you're sort of bred into whatever philosophy or whatever system. What I would say is more that the cost gets completely out of whack with testing. So all the tests that can be done. And I mean, we had crazy zebra patients who would come in. Zebra meaning like something, you know, super rare and nobody knew what was going on with them. And it's amazing how many tests can be ordered for a situation like that when you don't know what's going on. And when you become an attending and then you are in the office, you have to really think carefully about what is that patient going to be charged? What are they going to see on their bill? Because you're sort of in this bubble when you're a resident and you're not given a lot of training and tools about understanding how much money patients are going to be charged. You don't know what that bill amount is going to be when that patient leaves the hospital. You don't probably ever see them again. But when you're in the clinic and you're seeing somebody and you're saying, okay, hey, I think you need this MRI and I think you need these three labs done. And that patient says, well, I need to pay my rent this month and I can't pay for that. That's a really big deal. That's a really big deal.
Yeah.
And that's not something I remember in my residency very vividly. We had this EHR, this electronic record that would show you the dollar amount, but like it would be like $1 sign. It's like at restaurants and like the Zagat or Zagat review, how it shows you like $1 sign or $2 signs or $3 signs. So it would show you like, okay, a potassium is like $1 sign, but that's such a like, it's like a very esoteric thing. Like you really don't know what that means. And so when you then go out and practice, you really have to. It's part of being responsible. You can't just order whatever you want. It's not appropriate. It's not reasonable. It's not fair.
Yeah. And again, if you're the practice owner, if you're part of a practice where they give bonuses based on money saved, then it's an important thing to know and do. But I think even if you're not part of that type of system, it's still important for our healthcare system overall.
Yeah. And you're right. I mean, Medicare absolutely does reward physicians for actually saving money.
Yes, that is true. All right. Let's cover one more, a little bit more in depth, and we have a couple at the end we'll throw in there for fun. So what's the next one?
Sleep deprivation. How to manage sleep deprivation. So I remember in med school being tired sometimes, really tired, mostly from just studying constantly and being like exhausted from that. But I guess I didn't have a super rigorous surgery rotation. My OB rotation, I remember, was pretty rigorous. And I did have to stay overnight, but I had pretty nice residents. They would sometimes just let me sleep. I think you had a much more rigorous surgery rotation than I did. But I think just that the sleep deprivation that you have as a med student is just night and day from when you're actually in residency. And that's something that you are not taught how to handle at all.
Yeah. What would you have liked to have learned?
I think just, well, they tell you, okay, you're going to be working 80 hours a week or 120 hours a week. And great. Okay. Well, when you are working 120 hours a week, like I was at sometimes during my residency, and you actually start calculating how many hours there are physically in a week, there's something that's a little wrong. You start to really realize just how few hours you're sleeping. I think, again, it's just there should, in my opinion, there should be some time in medical school dedicated to how to take care of yourself. And as you go into residency, as you step into being an intern and a resident, how are you best going to take care of yourself? Because to be honest, I think that a lot of the trouble that we as physicians get into in terms of becoming depressed and even suicidal has to do with the pressures on us and the lack of coping skills and training about how to best take care of ourselves physically. And that means sleeping, that means eating well, exercising, all these things. There's not really, you really are sort of, you know, put into the pool and in the deep end, and they say, okay, good luck. You know, you have to figure it out on your own. And that's part of, I think, the part of growing a thicker skin, which is really an important thing. And I grew a much thicker skin in med school and then a super much thicker skin in residency. But I think we also are in some ways doing ourselves a disservice as physicians, because if we're not preparing medical students to go out there and be sleep deprived and work 80, but sometimes more than that hours a week, we're running the risk of our peers and colleagues becoming really sick and then depressed and even suicidal.
Oh, I think it's huge. I think it's a very, very huge.
Yeah, well, and like when you have a baby, I mean, you're sleep deprived and that's like a totally different thing. Yeah. I mean, I remember my mom, like I was saying to her, oh, I've been, you know, I was a resident, I'll be fine. And she was like, okay, Allison, yeah. You know, she was really kind and very nice about it, but she was sort of laughing internally. And sure enough, when we had our daughter, I was like, it's a totally different thing when you have a baby. And all of you out there who are, you know, moms and dads, I mean, you know this, you, it's just a completely different animal because you don't get to go home and sleep after you've been on call. There is no going home and sleeping. You're always on. But that said, I mean, I remember that before that, when I was a resident and I was just, I mean, it's to be that sleep deprived and to have to function well and take care of people and have these really hard conversations with people and, you know, be taking care of people who are at death's door. I mean, you have to be able to take care of yourself. And I think at the time we probably just relied on each other to get through it, you know, and great, but I think there are probably better ways to at least to kind of prepare people and to give people tools and ways of learning how to manage that. Friends of ours ask that, you know, they say, how the hell are you guys able to do that? You know, and I don't know. I mean, adrenaline is a powerful thing, I think. And that's what I've said. You don't think about it. You just go. There's nothing else to do. You have to be there. You have to do it. But I think that, you know, that doesn't always work for everybody.
Yeah, I agree. All right, so that was, I don't know, 5 or 6 different things we wish we would have learned in medical school. And then there were a couple more that we kind of threw at the end, and we'll talk about those real quick. Healthcare policy, quality improvement, and patient safety things. Now, those are more things from the administrative side, I think, but as physicians, we still have a huge part and a huge role in those. Do you have any thoughts on those?
Well, what do you mean by healthcare policy?
So healthcare policy, just the understanding of how things work in our government, how Medicare laws get passed, why are we still fighting for residency spots? Who's making those decisions? That type of thing.
So kind of understanding your place in the whole system.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. And quality improvement is huge. I mean, there's so much focus on that in every hospital that you'll work in, and people, I mean, which is great. People are always trying to make things better and also safer, which is the next one, which is patient safety. And I think patient safety probably would affect you the most as a resident when you're, you know, in med school and then as a resident, because you'll see things happen. I mean, hopefully not terrible things like wrong side surgeries, but, you know, near misses, things where maybe a patient was almost given the wrong medication or something like that. And so yeah. You have to become sort of an identifier of those things. But quality improvement too, learning how to always be trying to make things better.
Yeah. Increase efficiencies. And
again, even if you were exposed to these a little bit as a medical student, that would be a good thing.
Yeah. Awesome. Any last thoughts, Allison?
Well, I guess at the end of the day, some of these things you can prepare yourself for or get help from in medical school, and others you probably just have to experience for the first time. And that's part of the wonder of this this calling, this job, this profession we have, is that it, you will be exposed to things that you in other professions would never. And that's cool and that's awesome. But with that, it comes a lot of responsibility. And I think knowledge is power. It's always good to be as informed as you can. We always say that on the show. It's always good to be as informed as you can. And that's why Ryan does what he does. And I come in here whenever he lets me, and try to impart whatever help we can for you all out there. But yeah, be informed as early and as often as you can be.
Awesome. All right. Well, I hope you got a ton of great information out of the discussion today with the amazing co-host, Allison Gray, Dr. Allison Gray.
Aw, gee, thanks, Ryan.
Thank you for coming back.
Oh, see, you do it too. I caught that.
I know, but med stool, there's just something about stool and medicine.
Great, now there's going to be a hashtag out there.
Med stool.
Med stools.
Yes, I like it.
It's okay. It's okay to talk about poop.
It is okay. If you don't talk about it now, when are you going to talk about it? All right. I truly hope that you enjoyed this conversation, a little variety, not to interview with an amazing pre-med or medical student. And not some tips or tricks, but some good information that I hope helped. If you did like today's show, I would love for you to go to iTunes and leave us a rating and review. You can do that at medicalschoolhq.net/iTunes. We have a couple new reviews that I want to read. We have one from Cephalosporin, which is...
Oh, that's really cute.
Yeah,
I like that.
Cephalosporin.
As opposed to cephalosporin,
you like
an
that?
Antibiotic.
Scorin. I don't know what he's scoring.
Maybe scoring antibiotics.
Maybe. He's an antibiotic junkie. Okay.
He will never be sick.
Oh, wait.
Until
he
gets resistant bugs.
No, I read it wrong. He said, this podcast is Cephalosporin.
Oh.
That's not his username. I read it wrong.
But that's kind of cool.
His username is Dan Ban.
Oh. Well, thank you, Dan
with
Ban.
With a bunch
that's
of numbers.
Awesome.
Yeah. You know, goat? I talked about goat last time. You weren't on the show, obviously.
I don't know what goat is, other than it's an animal that says ma.
Yeah, no, you did. You saw this review, though. I showed it to you. I said, what the heck is goat? And I had a couple people email me that they said it means the greatest of all time.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Yeah. I thought it was something bad, and they're like, no.
I just thought it was an animal.
You old man. It means greatest of all time.
That's phenomenal. Well, yeah. Thank you. Wow. Yeah.
Anyway, Dan Ban says this podcast is Cephalosporin. He says, I discovered this podcast after getting accepted into a post-baccalaureate pre-med program after completing my bachelor degree in nursing. That's awesome. I've binged on a few episodes each day, and I sometimes find Dr. Ryan's Gray voice subconsciously narrating my everyday life.
That was my favorite part. I think that's awesome.
All right. What can we say to Dan Ban to subconsciously narrate tomorrow for him? I don't know.
I don't know. Keep doing what you're doing.
That was a little, never mind. Anyway, thank you, Dan Ban, for that. Again, medicalschoolhq.net/iTunes. You can leave a rating and review. We have one more here from future Dr. Stone. Said, if I could give more stars, I'd give more stars if I could. A music major, undergrad, first generation college student, finally going after my real dream to become a physician. So
phenomenal.
Good luck, future Dr. Stone.
I knew a Dr. Stone. He was one of my first mentors. So go get him.
Yeah, that's awesome. All right. Again, medicalschoolhq.net/iTunes to leave a rating and review. If you're in the middle of applications, in the middle of interview season, and you need some help with your interviews, go to medicalschoolhq.net/mock interview, and you can hire me to help you with your interview prep. I take students through the interview process. So we do a closed interview, open interview, MMI style interview, whatever you need for the school that you're applying to. I recommend you start early and you start often. Don't wait until you have that interview in your hands, because then you're scrambling at the last minute to prepare. And that's not something you want to do. The interview process is fun. It can be fun, but it can be brutal as well. But the most important thing to remember is that the interview and interviewing is a skill that you can learn. And I've taken students through 4 interviews, and from their first one to their 4th one, dramatic, dramatic differences. So again, medicalschoolhq.net/mock interview. You can also go to medschoolinterviewbook.com and sign up to be notified if it's not already out, an interview book that we have on the way for you to help you prepare for your interviews. All right. Again, I hope you enjoyed the awesome discussion I had with Allison today. And as always, I hope you join us next week here at the Medical School Headquarters and the Pre-Med Years podcast.